number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is...
Welcome to The Stuart Knight Show, where interesting, intriguing, and exciting people engage in unscripted exchanges of ideas, stories, and perspectives. It's not an interview. It's a powerful conversation.
Hey there, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to The Stuart Knight Show. This week, I'm talking to my friend Anthony Adams. Anthony really is one of the most interesting guys I've had the chance to meet in a very long time. He's an inventor, an entrepreneur, and has been named one of the top 25 bloggers in the world by Time Magazine. During this powerful conversation, we talk about things such as using music to check in with your feelings, what people are missing with religion, and Anthony's quest to walk in outer space. Here we go! Hey there, everybody. Welcome to the Stuart Knight Show. I am glad you can all tune in because I am about to have a powerful conversation with Anthony David Adams, an individual that I guess this is our second conversation. So welcome to the show, Anthony.
Hey, Stuart. Thanks for having me. Yeah, I think this is the second time we've been able to talk.
It's kind of funny, eh, how that works.
Yeah, I'm excited. I'm looking forward to seeing where we go with this.
Yeah, I know. Well, let's just to put it into context here. You know, I really remember our very first conversation in New York City. So you're in California right now, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm out in Palo Alto, California.
Palo Alto, okay. So, and I'm in Toronto. And the first time we met was in a cafe in New York City with our mutual friend Annie, who is the connector of many great minds, I believe. And it was fantastic. And I remember really enjoying that conversation. And I'm glad that we get to kind of have our second conversation now and see where it goes. So what's going on for you these days? What's making you happy?
Yeah, well, I just I'm recently in a new relationship.
Oh,
as of this morning, actually, I just got a brand new Dean guitar, and I haven't played a guitar in about 3 months. And so I literally, before I jumped on the call with you, was just ripping through songs, and I just can't keep my hands off her. She's beautiful, and I'm going to be with her for the rest of my life, I think. So it's a really good. Really great morning.
And that's amazing. How would you say your relationships, let's say, between a musical instrument mirrors your relationships with people?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think that for me, the biggest thing with music is that I've and art in general, but music in particular for me, is that it provides this incredible context for emotional experience. So I think that with me, I sometimes can have difficulty accessing like my heart in some sense. And I think that with music, there's this incredible opportunity for me to, just to kind of unleash and to play and to really kind of, it's almost like I understand how I'm feeling, when I hear what music comes out of me. So whether I'm composing and writing and just kind of in the moment. And I think that my best relationships also do that, right? So that the folks in my life that are able to kind of open my heart wider and let me kind of explore, that can kind of hold space for me in a way. So I guess that, yeah, the music and the art can kind of hold space for my emotional experience and kind of my just experience with life. And I think that, you know, my best relationships have that same quality and that same flavor, where they let me experience a part of my range that I might not normally be able to go.
That's really great. That's a great way of putting it. I know I played the piano for myself growing up. I took classical piano, and I was that classic kid, you know, where, God, man, it's like I told my parents this. I said, you know, I love you, but I wish you whipped me. I wish you backhanded me. I don't care what you did, because I was I had gone as far as grade 6, which is in Royal Conservatory, and there's only 10 levels, and by level 10, you're actually at a level you can teach. And I was, you know, that 13-year-old who had gone, you know, had really advanced. My hands were having a hard time even playing the songs because they were so advanced that my hands weren't even big enough to play the songs anymore. And I miss it. And sometimes when because I've written a couple of musicals and I will pull out little keyboards and I will just let my fingers go across the keyboard in ways that are not being dictated. I just let them go wherever they feel like they need to go. And it's true. You really can tap into a part of yourself that you don't expect. Now, when you are playing an instrument, or when you find yourself having a guitar back in your life, and maybe once a day you're strumming away, does it change, or does it affect the way that you approach your day? In a sense, like, does it get you motivated more, or does it relax you more as far as the rest of your day is concerned?
You know, it's interesting. This guy Josh just I found the guitar on Craigslist, and he dropped it off, and I said, just so you know, you're killing my productivity for the next like 4 days. It's all I'm going to do is play guitar. So I think that there's a feeling that I can. I mean, I'm on a certain level. I just have an awareness that yes, I mean, it's kind of like anything. Like when I play Ultimate Frisbee or I play a great chess game, that it gets my mind thinking in a different way. Mm-hmm. And so I sense that there's just an expansion, and like, I'm, you know, there's definitely an excitement. And especially if I've, you know, if I've kind of written a new song or I've connected to the music in some way. But I also think that because I'm exploring, you know, I really use music as a personal vehicle to explore my emotional state, that when I'm able to kind of, I mean, you know, sometimes I'm fine that I'm playing and I just like tears will start streaming down my face and like really unlock stuff. And so I know that when I've gone through those kind of cathartic moments with an instrument, with music, that the rest of my day is going to be much more creative, and I'm just going to actually have access to more. And I think that part of it's from the experience itself of just, you know, creating something in one domain. But there's also a sense that through that kind of cathartic emotional release that happens through playing, through composing, through creating, that it just frees up more energy kind of in my brain to just kind of be more, you know, be more there creatively, to kind of access even more.
I hear you. You know, it's funny when I hear you speaking, it reminded me this morning earlier on, I was doing something that I don't normally have the luxury of doing, which I, you know, can only blame myself for this, but I was reading a particular magazine that is very art-based magazine, and it mm-hmm. gives, you know, your typical movie reviews, music reviews, and as I was reading it, it was amazing how my brain automatically started having new ideas about speeches that I can be doing in the future, or some entrepreneurial concepts that I never even knew were in my mind. And it was because I had allowed myself to engage in something that is outside of the realm of what I normally engage in, that it was unlocking these thoughts. And when I look around at a lot of people that I see on the streets of Toronto or any major city, and especially those working in a 9-to-5 kind of corporate regimented environment, I feel mm-hmm. like they get so engaged in a routine where it's like, you know, you're obviously at the same place all day. A lot of the conversations are the same. And at the end of work, a lot of people will go out after work and then have drinks with coworkers talking about, once again, the same subjects. And then their relationship is really quite often just a reiteration of many of the same subjects. And they can literally go months without ever breaking free or just reading something completely different, or the idea of watching a movie that's unlike something that they normally watch. And I can only imagine it would just give them such great ideas for life.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that, you know, not only does novelty spur great ideas, it's also a great just source of general happiness, right? I think that one of the biggest factors in someone's experience of life is that if you can just optimize for novelty in some way, that you actually are happier, you're more fulfilled. And so I think that those two things kind of go hand in hand. And there's something about, you know, I think that there's something about having kind of a conscious growth oriented process where, you know, if it's like, for me, often in conversations, or just in kind of life in general, there's these moments where I'll feel, you know, I'll feel something in my chest or like in my heart. And it's a sense of, maybe it's like a nervousness or an anxiety. And for years, that would keep me silent. Like I would sense that and I would say, oh, like I it was almost like too intense and I didn't really, wouldn't speak, or I wouldn't, you know, get in front of the group and say what I wanted to say. But in the recent years, maybe the last 5 or 6 years or something, I've kind of actively coded in that feeling to meaning there's actually something here that you want to say and you want to experience. And without fail, Stuart, I found that when I do that, when I express myself in that way and kind of just recode that as like the radar for that I've got a message I need to say, it's always opened up like these. It's like it opens up a new door to a new dimension of reality. And it's always been, I mean, that's actually how I met Annie Lala. There was like that sense that I remember, that somatic feeling in my body, and then giving a talk in front of a group of people, and then immediately after, she and I connecting. And so that's like, in a way, the reason that you and I are having a conversation. So
That's interesting. So you're saying then that by taking that risk to express yourself on some sort of creative level, or just to even allow yourself to let your inner voice come out, are you suggesting that you are sending almost a different energy out into the universe to start attracting almost a different reality for yourself?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that it's changing the fundamental structure of your reality in some way, you know, and it feels to me very much, you know, I've been a student of Joseph Campbell for a number of years now. And I think that sense of, you know, following your bliss. And I think a part of that is, you know, being able to deal with the fear of self-expression that, you know, it actually is breaking you free from something. And you, to me, it's like, that's the signpost of an opportunity. And I've said before that fear is the gatekeeper of opportunity. And I think that there's a sense that when you feel that, you know, check to make sure your life is not physically in danger. I mean, and if, you know, if you're skydiving or something, maybe you still do it anyway, but,
sure.
but if it's like an emotional response, or if it's something where you're kind of scared of something that might happen socially or kind of in the context of the group you're in, to me, that's a great opportunity to just, you know, to try, have that new experience, to kind of, to break through and have that opening. And it to me, it really feels like it fundamentally shifts the paradigm that you're in, and you can't actually go back once that happens. That's like you step into a new level of reality for yourself.
That's so true. You know, it's funny. I don't know what it is, but I just recently started doing some work with a new client, and for some reasons, fear really started creeping up for me, and I found myself really needing to internally say over and over again, like a mantra, "There's no time for fear. No time for fear. There's no time for fear." And I'd say, "Fear's not allowed today." And it was amazing to me, just by repeating that over and over again, how it was forcing me to do things that I think that otherwise I would have not allowed myself to do. And you're right. When you said there is no turning back, it's been amazing. The results have been phenomenal. The client has been blown away and probably has ideas about me that would, you know, make them laugh if they knew how I was feeling 2 weeks earlier.
Yeah.
And you know, and it, you're right. You can't go back, because now I am that new person because I was willing to take that risk. You know, it's funny. Today is for you and I, obviously it's Good Friday, Easter Friday. And I was thinking about this as I was driving around Toronto today to just doing some errands. And at first I noticed, of course, that there were hardly anybody on the streets. And then, of course, it dawned on me like, oh, right, it's a holiday. I think that probably indicates kind of where I stand on the religious belief system.
Sure.
You know, I grew up with atheist parents, and so religion was never part of our lives. And so I find it interesting, though, as I did start, you know, looking around, noticing that people were going into churches and people were dressed up and they were kind of following, I guess it is the rules. They are, I don't know what you want to call it, the doctrine or the things you're supposed to do on a day like today. And I thought to myself, you know, I always believe, and I always wonder, like, when it comes to religion, how many of those people were willing to overcome the fears that are inherent with religion and to express themselves on a level that is more congruent with who they truly are, as opposed to this thing that they think they are.
You know, there's something that, I mean, you're so right on about that. There's, you know, my experience with the wisdom traditions of the world is that they're oftentimes just so misinterpreted that people don't get how to read or use a mythology, right? So I was in San Francisco and I saw a guy on the street with a sign that said, "Repent, follow Jesus," right? This is like a sign that he had, you know? And I started thinking about it. I thought, man, what is this? What is actually, you know, cause this has been translated through several different languages. And like, it's in this kind of, you know, 2000 year later context, like what actually was going on with that message? So what is, you know, what is the real message that's being conveyed with a sign that says, "Repent, follow Jesus"? And I thought, okay, well, so the root of repent, actually, it actually means to think different. Like it literally means like think differently about, you know, what you about the situation. And there's a particular, you know, lensing on the Christian mythology that Jesus is, it's yourself. It's at your core. It's like it's your heart. It's the intuitive, deepest part of yourself that is like the true self. It's not got the ego shame plex and social pressure stacked on it. And so literally when someone is holding up a sign, it's like, oh yeah, I totally get it. The actual teaching there is saying think differently and follow your heart, and
right.
And if you don't do that, you know, if you don't follow your heart in life, you actually have, you know, in the words of Campbell, you've capitulated to the devil, which is the, you know, the external value structures outside of you. And in fact, you are in hell.
Sure.
You're living in that fear of, oh, what am I going to do? And who am I going to be? The Eastern narrative is so beautiful from that perspective, in that, you know, there's this great story that is, this representative figure of the Christ figure, which, again, from one lensing, that is the ego structure. That is the kind of space-time dimensional being that exists. Mm-hmm. And there is this crucifixion process that you go through a death, you experience an ego death, mm-hmm. which, you know, facing literally when you face these fears, oftentimes social anxiety things, it's the somatic experience in your amygdala is, this is going to kill me.
Yes.
And when you face those again and again, right, you actually, there's a death that happens of old patterns, old behavior structures. You get to the bottom of that and you realize, hey, I'm still here. There's something here that is inside of me that survives all of this, the potential rejection, all these things. And when you make contact with that, Stuart, there's a sense that there's a rebirth. You actually come out as yourself, as your authentic self in the world. And that's the story. That's the death and resurrection story. And it's been twisted in so many ways that people get hung up on the historical accuracy or which things were. But when you get to the heart of these wisdom traditions, and I've spent time with many of them, and you see the same thing with the story of the Buddha and Siddhartha. They've got different flavors and different packaging, but you know, that hero's journey of facing your innermost fear, going to the bottom of it, and then bringing something back that's transcendent for the rest of the world, to bring your gift to the world. I mean, that's a timeless story, and one that we can personally experience every day without the dogma and without the, you know, the shame and guilt being stacked on even further.
Wouldn't it be so amazing if the world, if everyone would be able to kind of wrap their minds around that concept of what you were just talking about? Because people like you and I are obviously, we study these things and we engage in these kinds of conversations. And so it's not necessarily brand new, although it's still something that we need to work on a daily basis. Wouldn't it be just phenomenal that if we had a species that was walking planet Earth and was aware of the fact that they need to go within to die and then to be resurrected as a newer version of themselves, and to realize that that is in fact something that can happen more than once. It can happen many, many times throughout your life. And then, you know, people, in fact, they do it anyway, and they go through a divorce and they feel like they're dying. They feel like they'll never, ever be whole again. And then one day they wake up and they've shed their belief system. They've shed everything that they thought was true to who they are. And they've emerged as this, you know, quote unquote, greater version of themselves, one that's more able to serve their community, one that's better able to mentor and to lead, and they had to go through that death. But isn't it just so funny, the irony of that? You've got millions and millions of people who every day believe that is not the correct interpretation. In fact, it is something that, you know, they have to follow a particular doctrine, and if they don't, then they will go to hell, even though they don't realize they're currently living in it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a sense that, like as you said, we're going through this process anyway. I mean, that's the beauty of a mythology is that it's a mirror. And it's got a schedule on it. It shows you exactly where it's a mirror for your ego that has a schedule and shows you exactly where you are. And so the idea being, we're going through this process anyway. There's, you know, life has pain, life has struggle, life has suffering. It's a process of continuous rebirth and continuous, continuously stepping into new paradigms. And my sense is that if you've got that map and you've got that compass and you've got, you know, you can look to the world's wisdom traditions and be inspired by them. You can look to your community. You can look at nature. You can look at a butterfly emerging from a cocoon. I mean, it's like the message is almost inherent in everything that we're doing. Mm-hmm. But if you become aware of the process, I think Ram Dass talks about this, that you don't, it's not necessarily any less painful. In fact, it actually can become more painful because you actually experience deeper pain and deeper joy at the same time. You increase your capacity for aliveness, but it bothers you less. You're aware of the process, and so you're able to sort of move through these valleys and the peaks with a grace that may not normally happen if you're kind of just stumbling around and being ultra frustrated and kind of just, you know, bumping your head against the wall.
Right.
But the process is going to, it's happening. Process is going to happen. And, you know, to have some awareness around it and to really go inward, to me, that, that just, you know, that, that, but the thing is, we don't have necessarily a unifying collective mythology.
Right.
I think that that is one of the pieces that we haven't necessarily, built as a culture, but I think people are finding it. I mean, people are, you know, it's, you, you look at the people that are going deep in the spiritual traditions, people that are going deep into psychology, mm-hmm. And these folks are, you know, they're arriving at something that is, that's hinting at this, this, this process, that there's something bigger going on than just what's going on between our brains. And there's this process of growth and this, this, you know, in service of the community and the collective. And
I was thinking about, that actually this morning as I was waking up in bed, and which is a great place to wake up, I find.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't always happen for me, Anthony. But so I was waking up this morning, and I was thinking about how it, this is happening. You're absolutely right that we're living in a world now where slowly but surely people are, if you want to call it, for, you know, lack of a better term, beginning to think for themselves. And I think that, and I want to know what you think about this, I think that it's got something to do with that we are, whether it's because of technology or whether it's because, you know, developing worlds are in fact becoming developed. It's, I believe we're just, in many cases, buying enough time to think about it. And I think about, you know, my own parents, like when they first came to Canada from England, I mean, every single day was dedicated to just making sure you could get a job, getting food on the table for the kids, and then get your job, you know, after the kids go to bed, you go back to your work, and then it may be enough time to chat about, you know, okay, well, who's cutting the lawn on the weekend? You go to sleep, and then you repeat the next day, and then, of course, the weekend is just a madhouse because you've got to, you know, wash the windows and replace the roof, whatever it happens to, it happens to be. And so I believe now, though, that we are getting to a place in our lives where we have those moments where we can just sit back and actually think about it and say, does that make sense? Does it make sense that an individual would have maybe walked on water, or that whatever, a serpent came up and gave two people an ultimatum? And then people, when they have that time to actually think for themselves, they start coming up with answers that are much different than the old answers. And I believe that we're going to see a real kind of multiplier effect of that type of thought over the next 50 to 100 years. And today when I was laying in bed and I was thinking about this, I thought, God, wouldn't it be interesting if, let's say, in 1,000 years or 2,000 years, whatever you want, if there actually wasn't religion? Could you imagine, like, you're in your community, wherever you are in 2,000 years from now, who knows what that looks like, but you're talking about us, this generation, you and I, that we're living in right now, and they're saying things like, isn't it amazing that those people, they used to go into these big buildings, and they used to pray to these beings, and they used to live their lives according to these particular rules. Wouldn't it be interesting if that never, if that just ended and that ceased to exist?
You know, it's interesting. My sense is that, you know, when I was a freshman in college, and I had this guy, Dr. Rhodes, who's a brilliant political scientist, and his definition of religion to us was that religion is the thing that grips you most ultimately. It's the thing that is ultimately gripping you in life. And so I in that sense, geez, I hope that our species continues to have, you know, very deep passion, and that we're compelled by, you know, by something deep inside of us to kind of advance and move forward and to build and create and experience life. So in that sense, I would hope that we continue to have like that kind of, you know, religious experience, so to speak.
Right.
But then also the idea of religion or religious, the root religo, it's a sense of connecting back. It's a sense of, you know, what is the thread that connects us back to something greater? And my sense is that I am unable to imagine a future in which we ever escape the mystery. And in fact, I wouldn't want to escape the mystery. I mean, I think that, you know, science looking into the Big Bang and you know, quantum mechanics and parallel universes and all of this beautiful mystery and paradox that surrounds us, there's something beautiful about being able to connect with that and to live on that edge of, you know, you have this world that we have this amazing understanding of, and there's just this sense of wonder and awe that that's inescapable, and that we're very present to that. And so, and I think that that to me, that's what the religion is about. It's about connecting people to that sense of awe and wonder. And you know, if that happens for someone in a church or in a temple, and I actually enjoy going to these different places to experience them, because I love the mythologies, and I love being able to participate in a conversation about, you know, bringing them alive in the 21st century. But there's also a sense of, you know, you can have that, you know, quote unquote religious experience of something transcendent, of connecting deeply with the mystery of the universe. You don't need wisdom tradition for that. Right. I mean, yeah. You have yourself, you have that inside yourself every day. So, you know, what I would like to see perhaps is, you know, folks no longer killing each other in the name of God or in the name of their, you know, of their particular religious tradition, of their wisdom tradition. Mm-hmm. I would like to see folks and I, you know, actually being able to look at everything, you know, to not have this segmented experience of this is right, this is wrong, that they can actually approach it with eyes of connection, and they can find the inner truth inside themselves reflected in everything they come into contact with. In that sense.
Yeah.
So
I think that for me, that's where I find myself, without a doubt, becoming angry. It's like I have no problem with anybody having any belief. I mean, if you want to believe that a leprechaun is really, you know, at the shoestrings of controlling the entire world, that's cool. Go for it. But when you start killing people because you think that leprechaun does that, then that's a whole other issue. The other big issue I have with religion is that, and I've always found it so amazing that, essentially, women for many religions are second-class citizens.
Yeah.
And I have a real difficult time with that. I live in a neighborhood in Toronto, actually, right around the corner of a very Muslim neighborhood. And I see all the women, of course, walking up and down the streets with a burqa and with only a very small slit to be able to see out of. And I see their men walking next to them in a leather jacket and jeans. And I do find myself thinking, okay, you know what? That's totally cool, but if you can prove that that is supposed to be the way things are, like if you can prove that like there was some sort of higher being that absolutely said, yes, women are to dress that way and men are to, you know, that's where I start getting an issue with it, because I think I think that that's, you know, men, there's no shortage of examples in the history of time of men basically skewing rules for their own benefit, whether it was hundreds of years ago for the benefit of having, you know, more than one wife, or the benefit of having riches, or the benefit of having anything that makes you happy. If you make enough rules and get enough other men behind it, then you can start really making those rules reality. And then, of course, if you enforce those rules with violence, then there you go. You're off to the races. So that's where I have issues. But yeah, you know, when it starts getting into like, I've always found that interesting. Like, are there no women that ever stand up and say, you know what? Listen, I'm totally behind the Catholic Church. I love everything that you stand for. And as soon as a woman is also allowed to be the Pope, I'll start coming out. Like, I'm always amazed how women aren't more women that pissed off about that.
It's interesting. You know, I probably hadn't, I was brought up Catholic, and I hadn't gone to church probably in, I don't know, 10, 15 years or something. And I woke up one morning out here in Palo Alto, and I decided that I wanted to check out the church. I was like, oh, I should check this out. Mm-hmm. And it was on Martin Luther King Day. And so they had this kind of just, you know, a bunch of different people represented there. Mm-hmm. And so you had like this one woman that was a Jewish, I mean, this is just, you know, the kind of the labels that were like the Jewish lesbian rabbi speaking, the female priest, and I believe it was a Catholic denomination. And then you had like the universalist or, you know, Unitarian Right. And I get the names off. And they're all kind of delivering this message. And the message that they were delivering was one of revolution. It was basically saying, like, look, if you look at just, you know, if you don't, you know, if you look at kind of in historical context, you know, this idea of a Jesus figure, and it was a guy that was like basically a revolutionary, like talking about love and talking about, you know, connecting with yourself and loving one another, mm-hmm. and evolving the tradition. And what they were saying was, you know, for folks that are here, like your job is to question everything. Your right. job is to question the dogmas of the church. If you feel that you've had some experience that, you know, that God has given you a mandate, it's like you need to question God in that sense and ask, well, what is that? Like, there's a sense that there's an inner rebellion inside of yourself that can be profoundly spiritual, profoundly powerful. And it's a constantly evolving process. And so I think that to me was a very beautiful articulation of, you know, that idea of that revolution is kind of an active part of what spirituality is. I mean, there's right. a sense that, and this is something that, again, I got this, you know, learned this from Joe Campbell. He said that, you know, there are these mythologies and, you know, half the people, and it's, I guess, more less than half, but, you know, some people look at them and they say, oh, this is totally true. And, you know, and then they call themselves a theist. Other people look at it and they say, this is totally false. And they call themselves an atheist. And Campbell says both of them miss the point because they miss the ability to actually read and understand a metaphor. It's like a metaphor isn't true or false. It's actually designed to it's designed to transmit an idea. It's designed to transmit and actually create a state change inside of someone. To bring them into deeper connection, to bring them into deeper awareness, to bring them in direct contact with that sense of mystery mm-hmm. that someone might get, you know, when they go in a spaceship and they leave the Earth, and they, you know, we have this thing called the overview effect, where, you know, almost, you know, every astronaut that they've studied has had this, you know, what seems to track is like pretty much a mystical experience where they have a deeper sense of connection, awe, wonder. They come back, change. You know, they want to do these things in the world. So there's a sense that there's definitely room for it. And you know, these are slow moving institutions, and my sense is that they are evolving very slowly. Mm-hmm. But you know, the other thing is that I certainly have noticed in my own life, such a great deal of synchronicity and such a great deal of, you know, what I could only really describe as kind of miracles, on a daily basis, that it does feel to me that there is, yeah, there is some bigger process going on than just my subjective experience right now. That there is some bigger thing happening. Example is woke up, and just, you know, this string of synchronicities that have been so powerful. I've been working on synchronicity and gratitude as part of a coaching program that I'm developing. And so I actually started to track the synchronicities in my life. And this is pretty profound. I woke up one morning, this Saturday a few months ago, and I went and I purchased a laptop at the downtown store in Palo Alto. And this was like a really cool experience, like going in and looking at all these things and figuring it out. A little mm-hmm. bit stressful. So I ended up buying this laptop. It's $1,674. It's like kind of like, you know, whatever, new MacBook Pro.
Right.
I wake up the next morning and I watch this Ram Dass video clip. And Ram is talking about, he says, you know, he had this, he was like raised Jewish, had this LSD experience, went to India, studied with yogis, kind of became this spiritual guru and kind of leader of the 60s. Mm-hmm. You know, the whole be here now. And he said that later in his life, he had this sense of reconnecting to Judaism. Felt like he might have had some, you know, kind of have some work to do there.
Okay.
And so I thought, okay, this is interesting. So I'm gonna go check out a Catholic mass. I'm gonna go and, you know, go check this mass out. Mm-hmm. So I go to the mass, and you know, it's kind of the ritual and this stuff. And there's a cool sermon about love that's happening. And I stick around afterward and I have a conversation with the priest and some other people. And somebody there tells a story about a woman that was like in need of money, and she said a prayer, and literally she went directly to an old book that was on her bookshelf, opened it up, and there was like an envelope full of $5,000 just like sitting in this envelope. Right. So Wow. That's, I'm like, that's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. So I leave that church and I kind of get caught up on Stanford for like an hour. And then I'm walking home, and Stuart, I'm telling you, as I'm walking home, I step on an envelope.
Oh God.
Okay. Now I'm a kind of guy that, you know, picks up every penny that I see, kind of a student of Donald Trump, you know, and I open up every envelope because I'm just curious about what's inside of it.
Right.
And so I open up this envelope and it's kind of unmarked. It's got some Korean like lettering kind of printed on it.
Mm-hmm.
And inside of it are 36 50,000 won notes, South Korean currency.
Okay.
Okay. So Stuart, so I open up my phone and I'm kind of like, this is strange. I wonder how much 1.5 million won is.
Right.
I type it into Google. I'll give you one guess, the number that comes back on Google and the currency converter.
5,000.
No, $1,674, the amount that I paid for the laptop the day before, right? So I'm like, of course, I'm feeling guilt. It's like, man, this really ruined somebody's day. But like, well, this is like kind of Price is Right price, like the closest you can get to without going over, like the almost exact amount that I paid for this laptop the day before.
Oh, my God.
So I, you know, I call Stanford campus police and I report it to them and I say, look, I find a significant sum of unmarked currency. Somebody call me and claim it. I'd like to get back to them. I posted on Craigslist. It's been like 2 or 3 months and I've yet to hear back from someone. So, you know, my sense in that is that didn't take, you know, that experience didn't take like a huge infrastructure of dogma to get me there. That was like direct experience with something that for me had a profoundly powerful synchronistic experience. And I said, you know what, it's really important that this laptop that I just got is in deep service of humanity and that I'm using this in a way that's going to just really serve, you know, spreading this message of love and compassion and connection to the world.
Yes.
And that was the work that I was up to. So, we're doing the podcast on this laptop now. So here, I got to share that.
Oh.
first time I've shared that story publicly. So that's great.
I love that. That's such an amazing story. And I must admit that I too feel that there is some sort of beautiful energy that's going on. And that energy is the mystery of the world, whatever you want to call it. And
yeah.
I love it. I love the synchronicity. One of the things that I've been really noticing lately is the more money I give away, the more money that comes back to me. And I know this is not the first time anyone's heard this, but I really find that what's happened for me in the last 2 years is that business has, you know, as the, was it, and I think it was in Outliers where Malcolm Gladwell says when you hit that 10,000 hour mark. And I must have hit that at some point, but I did notice a major shift in business for me where it was just easier, let's just put it that way, to do my business and to get business. And because of that, that put me into a financial situation, and it has put me there where I'm able to buy nice things for people. And I've always wanted to do that, but as I was struggling as an entrepreneur many years ago, that wasn't available to me. And so it's been really fascinating to me. I've been noticing over especially the last 6 months that every single time I just, you know, I buy something nice for somebody, and I'm not doing it ever with the intention of it coming back to me, just because I just really love the opportunity to do it.
Sure.
Next thing I know, I'll get a phone call. Someone says, you know what, Stuart, we want to book you for this, you know, national conference. Our budget is through the roof. And we don't even want to look at any other speaker. We only want you. And it's like, wow, that's just becoming easier and easier. So yeah, I do believe that there is this incredible synchronicity and there's this matching of energy that is out there that if we're, when we put what you do put out does come back to you. Now, it's funny when you were saying that story, sharing that story just now about the envelope, it reminded me of the first time that you and I met when you told me, and I'd love to kind of check in with you to see what that's going on.
Yeah.
You told me that great story about your goal to go into outer space, and then how the very first trade, where I think there were some books in the garbage. Can you just remind me of that?
Yeah. So I guess it was about 3 years ago, and I started this project where I was this goal of, you know, to trade my way to outer space.
Yeah.
The goal was that I wanted to trade my way to outer space. And I was inspired by this guy, Kyle MacDonald, from One Red Paperclip. He's a fellow Canadian, actually.
I love that story.
And so, yeah, so I actually just kind of set out to do this. And I started out where I traded my little toy spaceship. I actually traded for, and it was all out, it was all space themed. So there's some stretching here, but I traded the toy spaceship for Kyle MacDonald's space bar off the keyboard that he used to wrangle all those trades. That was like, I reached out to him and, you know, got that. I needed, you know, to kind of christen the project,
right,
as opposed to just copying him.
And for those who don't know, I'll just say quickly, you know, that he, this guy had this great idea of trading a red paperclip, and his goal was to get a house, I believe.
Yes.
And he managed to do that. I believe it was in 14 trades.
14 trades. Yeah. And he did it, I think, in like a year. I think he did it like in maybe 12 months or something, which is pretty awesome.
Right.
So I got the space bar was my first trade. And then, I haven't told this story in a while. And I walked out of my apartment in the West Village, and sitting on the garbage bags out in front of my apartment were 5 books. Like they'd just been laid out in front of my apartment. And it was, I couldn't remember the names of these. It was like The Search for Life on Mars, you know, The Star Thrower, like all these space themed books, right?
Yeah.
And so I grabbed them, and I texted the girl I was dating at the time. I said, kind of jokingly, I said, I think the universe is trying to trade with me.
Yeah.
And I told my roommate when I got home, and he just looks at me like I'm an idiot and says, well, are you going to do the trade or not? Like, come on, dude. And I was like, oh, yeah, right. I totally have to. So I went and put the space bar kind of in this little ritual, put the space bar out on the garbage bags, and that was my second trade, right? So I'm like really making progress now. I've got the space bar, and I'm like stoked. I'm like, this is absolutely the universe. To trade with the universe for space books, obviously you're on the right path here.
Right.
I traded this woman, Kate Benazzi, who's an Australian artist. I just got an email like on Thrillist, and I saw a little logo for her work, and she had these like kind of these like Andy Warhol style like pop art silk screens, like beautiful silk screen prints of like astronauts and like this cool stuff. And so I emailed her. I just said in the subject line, you know, going to space, want to come. That was like my default email subject, and just 100% response rate.
Right.
And so she responded back, and she said yes, and she sent me a few $100 worth of these beautiful prints. So now this is actually getting somewhere. You know, it's gone from space bar in the books, and they got this like art that's like pretty awesome.
Right.
Beautiful stuff.
And did you have to send her the books?
I did. I sent her the books. So she's got the books. So yeah, I keep trading up for this stuff. So I sent the books to her. So Kate's got a nice little library of books in Australia. And there's just so much synchronicity baked into this whole story. And then I reached out to a guy named Vision, who runs a company called Mind Valley. You might be familiar with his work.
Okay.
I had met Vision just serendipitously once in a bathroom in Washington, D.C. I had put in a conference. We were like at a conference together, and I put in a request to meet with him at 4 p.m. And he never responded. Like I thought he was like blowing me off, but I guess he never actually logged into the service to see if he was scheduled for a meeting with me. And I walk into the bathroom, and I come out, and Vision's there, and we have this conversation, and it's like beautiful, and we connect, and I look at my watch, and it's exactly 4 o'clock. It was like I set the appointment, we got the appointment, whether he knew about it or not. So I hadn't talked to him in like a year or so, but I just emailed him. I said, hey, Vision, like, you know, we weren't really friends. We just had met and talked for a bit. I wasn't like talking to this guy, but kind of reached out to him and said, you know, looking into doing the space thing, and I know that you do stuff with like meditation, which to me was like this like inner space kind of exploration. And he ended up trading me a ticket to this event he does called Awesomeness Fest, which I kind of dubbed as this like inner space exploration,
right?
Which I think was like a $2,000 VIP ticket to go when he was doing it. I don't know what the prices are now, but it was like, you know, it's a super nice event. CEOs, cool people, authors, experts go to this thing.
Okay.
So this is like, you know, I guess trade four, and I've got this event. And then I traded that to the CEO of another Australian guy, this guy Matt Berry, CEO of a company called Freelancer.com. And Matt traded me a zero-G parabolic flight, you know, from Space Adventures, where you actually go in the kind of converted 747 and do the parabolic dives, and you get to fly around and experience weightlessness. So I had that. And I don't know if that was where I was when I think that's where I probably was when you and I met, potentially. Maybe there might be one other trade in there.
Okay.
I don't remember
you telling me about the last trade.
Oh, okay.
That's new to me.
There's a couple more that are kind of cool. So so that summer, something particularly interesting happened. I got to include this little aside because this is so pertinent to the story.
Yeah.
There was I had kind of like, I was on the verge of a falling out with one of my friends. Like some stuff went down. There was like a breakup. It was like pretty intense. And I was considering like eliminating this friend from my life. Like I was just like triggered and I reached out to like my Qigong instructor that I hadn't talked to in probably a decade. And I just like had this Facebook conversation with him. Mm-hmm. And he was like, Anthony, like this is what friendship is. Like that's a person that needs a friend. Like that's, this is, I was like, oh, I kind of got it. That like, that's actually the point of friendship is to hang in there when things get difficult, you know?
Right. Yeah.
It's like, oh, duh. So, yes, grasshopper. That's what friendship is. Oh, got it. So I ended up in all, but like most of my social circle was like kind of standing for like ending that relationship, which I thought was interesting, but I kind of went against the grain and just like repaired and really went deep and, healed that relationship. And I call him one day and I say, listen, I need a satellite launch company. Get me a satellite launch company. Like I'm joking, basically, just being like eccentric and like, because I have this idea that I can, you know, do something if I have a satellite launch company. Mm-hmm. He's like, yeah, I have no idea what you're talking about. I don't know anyone with a satellite launch company. I'm like, dude, just find me someone. Like, hang up the phone, like just being funny, eccentric.
Right.
I want to say within 12 to 24 hours, I get a phone call and he's like awestruck. And he's like, I'm at this bar in New York and I'm talking to this guy who like basically can get, he's your satellite launch company. And so this guy works for, owns, he's like an exec at this, an investment firm that only invests in saddle and, in space projects.
Right.
And one of their portfolio companies is this company, NanoRacks. So he introduces me to this guy and, this guy, Jeff Manbar, is the CEO of NanoRacks. And so he and I, and I don't know if you know Jeff Manbar, but this guy, I call him the OG, like the orbital gangster. This guy, it's at one point, this guy rolled over to like the former Soviet Union and like monetized all of their old assets. Like he had like a lease on the Mir space station. Like he was doing the craziest stuff, right?
Okay.
So I'm talking to this guy and he's like, do you know who I am? I'm like, you're a guy that my friend like met in a bar through a friend. Like, I don't know. And he's like, just Google me and you'll be on a different level with this. I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. So Jeff and I do a trade where I trade him the zero G parabolic flight for the ability. He goes, what he says to me is, I can't get you a satellite, but how about I do you one better? And I'm like, okay. He's like, well, how about the International Space Station? And I'm like, that's actually like the coolest satellite, actually. That's actually, there's no better. So he trades me the ability to send something to the International Space Station.
Okay.
So not a person, but like, you know, a smaller object. Because Jeff has a deal with NASA where he is the only private company that can put things on the NASA manifest. Uh-huh. And they do a lot of stuff with like education and experiments and all this stuff. So I'll open the veil a bit and tell you what's in the works. And this has been in the works with NASA for like a couple of years. It's like, this is the red tape that was really crazy.
Okay.
So what I want to do, what my intention to do, is I don't want to say the name, but I have a very, very famous artist, that I've been in communication with that is very interested in trading me, a ridiculously expensive, piece of art, if I am able to get his artwork on the space station. So I basically would trade him or her the right to send art, you know, to send something to the space station. And in exchange for that, I will have something that is like just crazy, crazy valuable that I could probably get several tickets to space for if it goes off. So I've been in this negotiation kind of back and forth with NASA to get the permissions required to do this art on the space station.
Right.
Which would be kind of the first of its kind in the world, and it's super beautiful and relevant. And but the good news is, I think we're making some headway. I need to actually go to New York in another month and meet with someone who's on, one of my mentors who's actually on the NASA Advisory Council, is going to see if we can just move that forward a bit more.
So hold on, you get this person's piece of art onto the space station.
And for the purposes of the trade, I'm going to say I'm trading you the right to send something to the space station.
Right.
But I kind of have to pad it in such a way that, I want to make sure that it's useful for that person. Like I just want to kind of cut through the red tape ahead of time. So that's, I'm kind of doing that work right now, saying I'll make certain you can use this to do the thing you want to do with it. That's the work I've been doing. And that's been a couple years, Stuart. It's been like, you know, kind of a process.
And so the ultimate goal is for you to do, if I remember correctly, a spacewalk.
Well, I mean, that would be the ultimate goal, but my kind of, you know, the bare minimum mission, trajectory is I just want to get above the Kármán line, which is, you know, basically it's like 100 kilometers above the Earth, and it's not on the space station. Just, you know, you go in like a Branson, like zero G or like a Branson Virgin Galactic or one of these other companies that offers the space tourism, and you fly up, you're there for 10 minutes or something in zero gravity, you're floating above the Earth, you see space, etc. But yes, I'm secretly, well, not, I mean, I'm not secretly, I'm talking about it, but I'm, you know, I'm definitely visualizing and fantasizing and looking for kind of the, the chess move that will position me to be able to get to do the world's first private spacewalk. And ironically, Jeff Manbar was, when he controlled the Mir, he was in talks with James Cameron in a deal with Sony IMAX. They were going to sponsor this deal to do the first private spacewalk with Cameron.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was the U.S. government basically just said to this to the they weren't Soviet. I don't know. I forget. My geopolitics is rusty. I forget what, you know, the folks that were controlling this former Soviet space station,
right.
They basically just said like, yeah, no, you're not going to play with that toy any longer. And it's like, we basically bullied them out of the sky. And so like, we're just not letting you have that. So that deal fell through. So there's still this like sense of, you know, the first private citizen doing a spacewalk. And, you know, I'm in contact with the companies and the people that can make these things happen. And I think I've just got one hell of a public relations, platform for them. If they just like kind of a turnkey, you know, $1 billion public relations platform, if they want to play ball with me on that. So,
absolutely.
I know what
I love about that is it really is just such a classic example of the fact that, you know, you can almost say, what do you feel like doing today? And I say this to people all the time where they'll say, I don't know what I want to do with my life. I don't know. I want to do something exciting. I want to have adventure. And they say, I don't know where to start. And I always say the same thing. I say, start anywhere, because anywhere is a place, and anywhere will lead you everywhere. And once you start somewhere, it just forces you to go to that next step. And this is a great, you know, example of that, about how you started off with a little toy spaceship, and now you're literally going to be flying to New York City next in a month and to have a serious conversation about moving this idea forward. And it's, to me, it sounds like whether or not you get the spacewalk, it seems almost now at this point almost a no-brainer that you'll at least go up and do one of those experiencing weightlessness, and you will go into outer space.
I mean, I'm grateful for how far I've gotten. It's been a ridiculously short number of trades. And actually the bulk of those trades happened within like a 4-month period. It was just like back to back to back. Everybody just said yes. Like,
right.
I literally just sent like 6 emails and this happened like in my spare time.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting back into that flow state and really reconnecting with it creatively. And I went through a breakup during that. I was in kind of a really challenging kind of process spiritually, romantically over the course of those 3 years. And I know for me, if my heart is off, like if my heart is elsewhere, it's really hard for me to be in a place of kind of that manifestation, creativeness, just like being in the moment, like making all that, like kind of seeing the possibilities. So,
right.
I've kind of come through that and I'm like, oh yeah, that was actually super fast. And like, just get on that plane and go to New York and do this meeting. Like you just need to have a couple meetings and this works. So
yeah.
I'm kind of, you know, stepping back into that. And you know, the whole, and of course this whole thing is, I was an education activist. Like that was kind of like probably one of my earliest from as a kid. And the whole project really was to create this narrative and a vehicle around space exploration for students. And our plan is that when we get into space, we're going to be giving these outer space exploration curriculums to every school district in the country. And we'll make an open source version available for everyone in the world, which basically lets them use an old iPhone or smartphone and a helium weather balloon and send a camera up, you know, 100,000 feet and shoot video footage of the curvature of space. And we provide this whole 360 curriculum of how to integrate and like these non-traditional pathways to space. So I was just like, I want to just do something fun. I'd love to go to space. And if I can create a story that inspires some, you know, inspires the next generation to look to the stars in non-traditional ways, because, you know, I'm definitely believe in, I'm kind of a student of Stephen Hawking in the sense that he says, you know, if our species wants to survive, you know, the next 10,000 years, like if we want to have a chance of long-term survival, we really do have to take to the stars, right? Because at some point our sun's going to red dwarf. I mean, it's a long way off, but at some point we are going to need to, the humanity is going to have to leave planet Earth.
Right.
And so, you know, for me, in terms of my long-term legacy vision, if I can inspire some student that, you know, sees that possibility and is up for that, you know, I think that is, I'm trying to kind of be that Johnny Appleseed of space in a sense for people to help encourage them to think about that. And of course the kind of cool story of just creating an inspirational narrative. It's like, yeah, I got to space with a toy spaceship. Like I rode my toy spaceship into space, you know?
That by itself would be so inspiring. You know, it's funny.
Yeah.
I think that it's actually, it's kind of embarrassing when we look at our education system, and that we don't have as much of an emphasis on outer space as we should. And I sometimes find myself even just driving my car down the road, down the highway, and I'm coming back from a speech somewhere. And I just love once in a while, you know, of course, not for long because I am driving a car, but I glance up at the sky and it doesn't, it can be daytime or nighttime. And I'll think to myself, man, I'm driving a car in outer space.
Yes, exactly. You're in space. We're in space. We're there.
People forget that, right? Or I'm walking in outer space. I'm making love in outer space. Like you can just choose the thing that you're doing. And and I think to myself, God, I mean, I don't know what it was like for you, but I remember growing up, I mean, we were given the basics. There's the moon, there's the sun, there's Saturn, you know, Jupiter, whatever. And we were never ever really kind of encouraged to get excited about outer space. And my God, what an incredible circus is going on up there. What an incredible, it's the greatest musical of all time. And people are missing it all the time.
Well, I think we're going to start getting up there more, but you're right about the education system. I mean, I think it's, you know, encouraging curiosity or excitement was not really in the DNA of the, at least in the structure, you know, the kind of contemporary structure that we have here of just, you know, basically just training people up for low level clerical work. Mm-hmm. But I think that, just reconnecting people with the passion, the curiosity and the wonder that exists out there, of course, and also inside. I mean, it's like outer space and inner space. It's like there's something about both of those things that feel to me to be so deeply connected. You know, they say that when you go into space, you have this experience that is one, no matter how many textbooks you've read or how many flight simulations you've been through, you know, you have this direct experience that countries and borders and laws and all of these things are, they just exist in the minds of men with guns.
Yes.
And they don't, they're not actually real. And all of these rules and structures that people are following are just arbitrary. And that there's a sense of understanding on a deep somatic level, your oneness with the entire species, you know, and with the planet, and just being a part of it. This is your home, and taking care of it, and just, and the mystery of what's beyond, you know, being in that, and just seeing the Earth hanging in a, you know, this fantastic blackness with the backdrop of the stars, and you know, it's just, and so there's, I think that very similar, Stuart, to the way that that first photograph of the Earth that appeared on the Whole Earth catalog, you know, back in the day, I think it was like in the 60s, that kind of changed the conversation and paradigm around the environmental movement. I think that there's going to be a similar effect that happens in a way. And maybe this is, you know, maybe the church of the 21st century is actually going to be, you know, outer space, right? You enter the cathedral of the universe and just commune there.
Right.
But I think that those experiences are going to be opening people up much more into what we think about geopolitical boundaries, the boundaries within ourselves and the planet. And I think, you know, that there's something deeply beautiful about our connection with space and how our relationship with outer space is going to be shaping the future of human evolution for, you know, generations to come.
Oh, I couldn't even agree more. I mean, this is where I have all kinds of concerns, as much as anybody else does, about technology. But when I think about these kinds of things, I am so grateful for technology, only because it is making it so much easier now and so much more possible that within the next 100 years, it is so safe to say that we're going to literally have hundreds and thousands of people who will have that experience where they go into outer space and it's affordable. Let's say, you know, today, I don't know what it is, call it $200,000 for a ticket. Let's say in 100 years, it's going to be maybe, I don't know, $1,500 for a ticket. And to have more and more people on planet Earth going in, looking back and seeing it, and then having that moment like you talk about, and I've heard about that before, that people who are astronauts, when they go into outer space, they look back at the planet and they think to themselves, what the hell are we doing? Like you said, those are arbitrary lines. Those are lines that were built because, you know, certain people just had more guns, or at that time more swords at that. And they managed to just carve out space. But that's, we are one species. I don't care what color we are. I don't care what kind of religious beliefs we have. We are one species on one planet in the middle of goddamn nowhere.
Yeah.
We should probably get along.
Absolutely right, brother. Amen. You know, there's a piece one of my all-time favorites, I had a chance to interview Ray Kurzweil a while back about technology in the future. And There's an article, an interview that's evolution is a spiritual process. That was kind of the, you know, one of the things that came out with that interview. Mm-hmm. And you know, that was one of the things that Ray and I talked about. It, you know, I said, how's love going to change, you know, with technology? And his sense was that, you know, the things that we think of as God is a culture, you know, this kind of omnipresent, all knowing, deeply compassionate, loving, can make anything happen kind of being. He's like, our technology is bringing us closer and closer to that ideal, that we become more connected, we become more compassionate, you know, and that we become more like this kind of, you know, whether that's just our internal highest self ideal, whatever that concept is of this, you know, this powerful energy, we become more in line with the universe itself through that process.
Right.
And as much as technology can be a tool for, you know, for evil or for, you know, really, really just like to basically, I would say, defending ego narratives.
Sure.
It can also be a tool for the annihilation of ego and to really bring people closer and connective.
Yeah. Isn't that exciting? I mean, I love that. I mean, even the fact that we've used technology to have this conversation, one that would not have been able to really happen within the last 15 years, or I would have had to probably spend $10,000 worth of recording equipment just to do it over the phones and to do it over Skype for free. And to be able to record it and to know that there's like literally hundreds and thousands of people who down the line will be able to hear this and then from there gain their own ideas. I mean, this is just a perfect example of how technology is changing the way people see the world. It's affecting the way that they see themselves, their identification with the self and the identity itself, and how that... you know, this is just one conversation, but how many thousands and thousands of podcasts there are out there, how many thousands of YouTube videos are all systematically changing a person's psyche and the way that people see the world. So what I get excited about is the exponential effect, is that we could just be on that cusp of, you know, they're talking about with nanotechnology and artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
And talking
singularity.
About, yeah. Mm-hmm. And how we're literally now just on the cusp of really hitting that major exponential effect of how the technology we create today is building the technology of tomorrow. And obviously allowing us to create things that right now the majority of the world's population can't even imagine. And so it's exciting. As long as we don't use it to blow each other up, we should be okay.
I agree, man. And it's cool you're saying this. Can I plug something? Can I say, I just want to tell you that I've got this new column with Forbes.com that is called Cosmic Awareness.
Okay.
And it's about the interplay of, technology and the future of the human species. And it's virgin. So like and in fact, by the time people hear this, they might actually, I might be publishing the first kind of interview or the first article on there. So, If you've got ideas for that, that would be pretty awesome. It sounds like I might actually want to, you know, maybe we can embed this somehow in that place to share this part of the conversation with folks.
It's funny that you say, can you plug something? Because we actually have, I don't sure if you know this, but we actually have hit the 1 hour mark on this conversation.
Yeah, and, yeah. There we go.
And so, you know, I do want to people who are listening to this, I'm sure that people who are listening to your enthusiasm about the world and some of the things that you're working on would be extremely excited to be able to follow you and to be in your world. So what are the main ways that people can follow you and do that?
You know, I'm on the Facebook, you know, so it's just Anthony David Adams. If you know, folks want to find me and friend me or follow me there, Twitter, it's just Anthony Adams, and folks can email me, at Anthony@175g, it's like 175grams.com. And you know, I've got a bunch of different stuff happening, a bunch of different companies and projects, but you know, if someone's heard something in this conversation that's moved them and they'd like to have a conversation with me, just, you know, shoot me an email or something. We can figure out what you're up to and,
that's,
you know, and take it from there. Cause there's just way too much stuff to be like here, you know, but
I know.
But you know, we talked about onetoyspaceship.com. That would be if they're interested in the space stuff, which is what we talked a lot of stuff about. Check out onetoyspaceship.com. If you're into gratitude and synchronicity, gratefulchief.com is a new book project coming out in gratitude and synchronicity. So I'll leave it at that. There's a lot more, but you know.
Oh, wow. Well, that's one of the things I that I really like about you is that you I'm quite convinced that you haven't slept for at least 2 or 3 years.
ADHD is an incredible thing.
I know. I love it. This is the reason why I've had so many relationships come to an end, is because usually the girlfriend just looks at me and she'll start crying and saying, I need sleep.
I didn't sleep last night. I was up in anticipation of this new guitar coming. It was like, you know, which I'm gonna return to when we close this podcast.
I won't keep you from that. You know what I want to say, Anthony, when I listen to you speak, and when you and I have now only had two connections, the one thing that happens for me is I find myself, the only bad thing that comes out of it is I wish that either you lived in Toronto or I lived, you know, in California or somewhere closer, so that we'd be able to have these conversations more often. But I definitely, I really appreciate you as a person, and I know that the world is better off for having guys like you who do explore, who do want to make such a big difference, who do allow themselves to be open to new ways of thinking about life. And I know there's no doubt about it in my mind, anybody who's been listening to this conversation is definitely going to walk out with a new perspective. And so I really appreciate you taking the time. You're a good man, and I hope that we get a chance to connect soon.
Stuart, this is beautiful, man. I'm so grateful for the opportunity. This has been a blast. And absolutely, I'll set an intention for 2014, the rest of this year, that I'll find a way to connect with you again, whether in person or, you know, some other way. We can have some more conversations. Absolutely.
That is a deal, brother. We're going to sit down and we'll share many coffees or maybe, you know, a few hundred beers. We'll see what it is.
Maybe in outer space.
I love it. All right, brother. You take care. Enjoy the rest of your day, and I'll speak to you very soon.
Yeah, cheers, my friend.
See you.
Goodbye.
The number you have dialed has been changed. The new number is...
Thank you for tuning in to The Stuart Knight Show. We hope you have enjoyed this powerful conversation. People are fascinating, and so are you. And the right questions will prove it.
Thanks for tuning in, everyone. I really enjoyed my conversation with Anthony this week. He's a great guy, and I hope that you enjoyed it too. I really do strongly encourage you to follow him, as he is a true thought leader, and you're going to get a lot out of the things he's sharing with the world. And finally, it would mean the world to me if you took a few seconds out of your day to share this podcast with your network. You can do that on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, or wherever you show up in cyberspace. I really do want to engage the world in powerful conversation, and together we can make that happen, so please do share it now. I look forward to connecting with all of you again next week, and until then, remember, powerful conversation, powerful life.